News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. The show is Hometown Heroes because of the theory that no matter where you go in this great country of ours, there are heroes in your hometown. No matter how big or small that hometown may be, no matter if it's west, north, south, or east. And this week we head all the way to Brunswick, Georgia on the Atlantic coast, sandwiched between Savannah and Jacksonville down in the southeastern United States. And it's a very interesting connection we're going to make today. You know, I'm often accused of being a little too sentimental or perhaps melodramatic. A lot of times on this show when I talk about a veteran surviving, I'll mention that he has children or grandchildren that never would have been here if he didn't make it home. That's the case for me if my grandfather hadn't made it back from the war. And today I can honestly tell you that this show might not be on the air on KMJ without the guests that we have today. We're going to take a circuitous route to get to that, but let's start now. I want to welcome my guest, 90-year-old Lou Essick of Brunswick, Georgia, joining us today, originally from Toledo, Ohio. And Lou, is it safe to assume that Toledo is where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Yes, it is safe to say that. I was in Toledo when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
What do you remember about that day? Because you had, what, four boys in your family?
Yeah, right. Well, I remembered, I didn't get the significance of it at first because I wasn't too familiar with Pearl Harbor, believe it or not. The story kept unfolding and unfolding, and I says, my gracious, what a catastrophe. And I remember listening to President Theodore Roosevelt declare war on Japan right after that happened. And I sat there, I was in the lobby of a building, and they had the radio on, and President Roosevelt came on the air and talked about the dastardly attack by the Japanese, and I remember his words, we shall win. No, that was Winston Churchill. He said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And that stuck with me.
Well, and you say it didn't hit you fully right off the bat. That less than a year later, you were drafted, so I'm sure it hit you by then. But between December of 41 and August of 42, when you were drafted into service, did you have a lot of things going through your mind in terms of maybe you would get involved in what was going on in the world?
Yeah, it crossed my mind. And, of course, if I were to be called, I was happy to go because, you know, I think the world of this country, even before all of that happened, it's a wonderful country, and I said if anything happened, I would want to be a part of it. And so I prepared myself mentally for what might come, and it finally came.
And not just for you. I'm sure your mother had a few nervous days throughout World War II. How many of you brothers ended up going overseas?
Well, Paul, there were four boys in the family. I had two older sisters. I had one younger brother who was too young to go. His name is Sylvan. He lives in Lima, Ohio. But there were three of us, my big brother David, myself, and then my younger brother Morris, whom we called Pip. My brother Dave was in the Buckeye Division out of Ohio in the infantry, and he wound up in the Pacific. And, of course, I and my brother wound up in Europe, in France, of course.
And when you were drafted and you found out you were going to be working with automatic weapons, and I'm just curious, as a kid, you'd probably read the comics, seen some shoot-'em-up movies. Did the idea of having some powerful guns to play around with intrigue you a little bit?
Well, let me tell you a funny story, if I may, Paul.
Sure.
When we arrived at Camp Wallace, Texas, which is between Houston and Galveston, they designated my position as a cook. That was specified an 060, a cook. So they put me in the kitchen, other than my other duties, cleaning the latrine and the barracks and so forth. But they put me in the kitchen, and one day my mess sergeant said to me, Private, we're going to cook up some squash today. And I had, believe it or not, I had never heard of squash. And I said, well, how do you prepare squash? He says, you don't know anything about squash? So he dismissed me and sent me back to headquarters. And from that, I started off on another job. The first thing I knew, I was on my way to Los Angeles, California, to National Schools at the corner of South Figueroa and Santa Barbara, and it was an electrical school. They sent me to an electrical school, but I had no idea why I was studying electricity.
I'm sure you'd find out eventually, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, what happened was the guns that they had me work on, the 40 millimeter anti-aircraft guns, and the Quad 50 machine guns, believe it or not, were all run, could be run electrically by remote control. We had all of this remote control equipment that I can't very well describe to you, but the guns could be run by remote control, and that means electricity, and I had to learn all about this electricity. We had these giant generators, we called them power plants, and oil gears on the guns connected to the power plant, and it was quite a setup, but found out later on that all of the parts that we had for these guns became obsolete because they were not too mobile.
And you would need to be mobile once you found yourself overseas. And I guess in thinking back on that, it sounds clearly like the electrical work was a little more intriguing to you than the kitchen was. But maybe if you had known how to prepare squash, your life would have turned out a whole lot differently.
Yeah, I would be cooking squash for my wife tonight, I would. But that's the way that turned out. And after I left Los Angeles, we lived the life of Riley there. They put us in some nice apartments, and of course, we had to wear dress uniforms and look like decent soldiers as we walked the streets of Los Angeles. But it was a 2 to 3 month course, and then from there they sent me to Camp Davis, North Carolina, between Jacksonville and Wilmington, and from there I joined my outfit, the 776th. I was assigned to them, and that was it.
The 776th AAA, Anti-Aircraft Artillery. You're part of the Automatic Weapons Battalion, and they call that the Liberty Bell Battalion?
I believe so, yeah, I believe so.
I guess, but because of 776 and 1776.
Yeah right. They were good numbers. We we were proud of those numbers, but there were four batteries, A, B, C, and D. Each battery contained 8 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns and 8 Quad 50 machine guns. Those are 450 caliber machine guns mounted on a turret that was also run by electricity. But they were very powerful weapons. They were meant for low-flying bombers and strafing planes. They worked very, very well because we got a few.
And we're going to hear about that, some of the ones you got, some of those that were too hard to get, and how that led to another twist in your story. I'm curious, though, in your position, fire control for this group of guns, what does that entail for our listeners who maybe haven't been in the military or maybe even haven't heard some similar stories on the show before? As the fire control man on that crew, what did your duties entail?
Well, think of an automobile mechanic, Paul. It was my job to make sure that these guns were kept operable. You know, they had a lot of moving parts in these guns, and it was my job to keep them oiled, operable, and in use all the time. That was primarily my job. As a matter of fact, last night I brought out my old manual that I carried with me for my own purpose of repairing these things. And I couldn't believe all the parts that went into these guns, like the breech where you put the shell for shooting, you know. You could put it on automatic fire. You could put it on single fire. And, of course, everything else that goes with it. The gun had to traverse very, very smoothly for the operators on both sides of the gun, one who operates the azimuth from side to side, east to west, at elevation north to south. And together they had to get a bead on the plane they were tracing. And then once they got that aim right on the plane, then of course they hollered to the gunner, fire, and that was it. It was a team effort. You had a whole team on that gun doing their job. Yeah, as I said, it was my job to keep all of those machine guns and 8 40-millimeter guns operable, keep them functioning. You know what I mean?
It seems to me that it would be awfully hard to simulate. The experiences that you guys would eventually have overseas. But before you went overseas, did you feel prepared? Did you feel like you had training that in a combat situation, you guys would be able to operate those guns and do it right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We went through some very, very hard training before we got on our ship to go overseas. As a matter of fact, our last stop was Camp Edwards, Massachusetts, and they put us through our, you might say, final exams. And so we were well prepared. We knew our jobs. The gun crews knew their jobs. And we worked as sort of like a baseball team or any team. They felt like we were ready to go, so they sent us over.
What was going through your mind as you headed across the Atlantic, knowing that you were going to be in some things you had never experienced before?
Well, butterflies, and apprehension, and a little bit scared. A little bit scared because, war is war, and we knew what was going on over there. We knew who we were going to go against. is sort of mixed emotions, frightened, proud, the whole ball of wax. It was just mixed emotions. But we were all happy to get over there and get this thing on the road because, at that time, Mr. Hitler had the upper hand pretty good.
Well, that would change. And what you and the rest of Patton's Third Army did had a lot to do with it changing. I'm curious.
Yeah.
You talked about your two brothers that were in the service, and one of them was in the Pacific. Your younger brother, Pip, ended up in Europe as well. As you're heading overseas, did it cross your mind, hey, I might be able to meet up with my brother?
Yeah, it sure did. As a matter of fact, I said to myself, we kept in touch by mail, and I had a pretty good idea that before the invasion, we might have a chance to meet. And he was up in a little place called Shrewsbury, Shropshire. It's a beautiful little town, very quaint town in England, up the eastern side. And I was in, we settled, our outfit was, when we landed in Scotland, we got aboard a train and we found ourselves going to Wales. And so we were right across the river from Wales near a place called Land's End, minor village, a couple of places like that. But it was sort of the Key West of England down there at Land's End. We were in that area. And I found out where my brother was, and my commanding officer, this before the invasion, gave me permission to, we managed to contact each other. I asked if I could go visit him, and my commanding officer said, yes, you sure can. He gave me a couple of days off, and I got aboard a train and went to Shrewsbury, and I was standing at the Red Cross there and waiting for my brother to arrive, and he walked up behind me. He says, hey, Pat, you got a match? He was lighting a cigarette, and I turned around. I didn't even recognize him at first, and then I did that Hollywood double take. Oh, my gosh. Pip, it's you. And we hugged each other, and we had lunch that day and had a wonderful visit. And then, of course, when the visit was over, he walked me to the station, the railroad station, put me aboard the train. And after I hugged him and kissed him on the cheek, I says, I tell you what, I'll see you in France, Pip. He says, you got a date, Lou. We'll see each other there. And that was the end of that, and the train rode off, and he waved at me, and that was the last time I saw him.
Well, and we'll leave the story right there because it's time for our first commercial break. But when we come back, we'll hear what happened after that to Lou's brother, Pip. We'll also hear Lou's experiences when he witnessed a couple of generals whose names you might know, General Patton, General Eisenhower. He has stories about both of them, the story of how the war ended for him, and what he's been doing since World War II. We've got a lot to cover with 90-year-old Lou Essick of Brunswick, Georgia, and we'll be right back with Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, Lou Essick, 90 years old. He served with the 776th AAA. If you don't know what AAA stands for, how about anti-aircraft artillery? That's what he was busy with during World War II in Europe. We haven't heard any of his combat stories yet. When we left off, Lou had told us about visiting with his younger brother, Pip. There were three Essick boys who served overseas during World War II, and he had a chance to meet up with Pip in England. When they parted ways, they pledged to meet each other in France because they knew they were both headed that way. And Lou, you headed over, got to Normandy about, what, a month after D-Day?
Right. We landed with the 3rd, and we landed on Omaha Beach, as usual. We went over on Liberty ships, and when we got to Omaha Beach, the channel was so rough, we couldn't get off the ship. And there were a lot of us and a lot of ships. And so we had to sit out on the English Channel for about a day till it calmed down. And then we climbed off our ships onto a raft. And that night, we did that late at night, and we slept on Omaha Beach that night and got up the next day and found ourselves in a little village called Isigny, I-S-I-G-N-Y, Isigny. And from there, we had to find out where we were to go from there and where we were going to draw all of our supplies, our rations, our water, et cetera, et cetera. My captain had a Jeep driver, believe it or not, who from our hometown, too, Toledo. As a matter of fact, his Jeep driver lived about a block from us in our hometown. And his name was Orth. And I told him, I says, look, I says, we've just gotten here, I says, and I know we haven't captured a whole lot, so I want you to be on the lookout for the 216th Signal Supply Depot. And that was the outfit my brother Pip was in. So he had to go out with our first sergeant and our mess sergeant to find out where we were going to draw our supplies. And I told him, I says, when you're riding around, I'll be on the lookout for that outfit and see if you can find them. Well, he went out with the first sergeant and the mess sergeant, and they were out looking to, as I said, where we were going to get our water and where we would draw our supplies. And he came back, and he said, hey, come here, Sarge. I want to show you something. And he walked me out to this road, and he says, look down the road. He says, you see a little T sign hanging down the road there a little bit, just like a for sale sign? And I looked down the road. I said, yeah, I sure do. He says, well, that is your brother's outfit. I says, are you kidding me? He says, no. He says, that's the 216th sign. He says, I caught it coming back. So I immediately went to my commanding officer, Captain Burke, and asked him if it would be possible for me to go down there and visit with my brother for a little bit. And at that time, he said, he looked around. He says, well, he said, I'll tell you what, that Jeep is going back up there in just a little bit. He says, why don't you get aboard and hop out and go see your brother, and they'll pick you up on the way back. So I went with the boys, and they dropped me off at the 216th, and there was a guard in a sort of a guard shack. You've seen these old telephone booths? Well, he was in something that looked like an old telephone booth we called a guard shack. And I walked up to him, and I says, son, I says, I'm Sergeant Essex. Morris, my brother's name was Morris, and I said, I'm Morris Essex's brother. And I'd like to know where he is, and I'd like to see him. And he said, well, he looked at me kind of funny, and he cranked up a telephone, excuse me, and he called back, and he said, sir, I've got a Sergeant Essex out here who's here to see his brother Morris. What shall I tell him? And I said, what's going on here? And so he says, he hung up. He says, yes, sir, he hung up. He says, if you'll just walk down this path, Sergeant, there's an officer who will meet you, and he'll tell you all about it. I said, is there something wrong? He said, well, he says, you just go down that path and meet the officer. And it was a warrant officer. And I walked down the path, and the warrant officer came up and greeted me. I says, you don't salute a warrant officer, so I didn't worry about that. And I said, I'm here to see my kid brother, Morris. What's the problem? Is there a problem? He says, no. He says, come on with me, and I'll let you talk to the commanding officer. The commanding officer was a Major Wolf. So I walked into Major Wolf's office, and I gave him a big salute and said, Sergeant Essex, sir, I'm here to see my kid brother. Is there a problem? He says, your kid brother's dead, just like that. Oh. And of course, I completely went down, collapsed almost. It hit me so hard. He told me to sit down. He had an old ammo chest there, ammunition chest. He kept things. And he said, sit on that thing. He says, and when you get settled down, he says, we'll talk. And so he also reached into that chest and got me a handkerchief for my tears. And I settled down a little bit, and I said, what happened, Major? And he says, well, he burned to death. Sorry, I hate to tell you, but he burned to death. And he died of second-degree burns and scorched lungs. So I immediately started to bawl again, but then I calm myself. He says, I'm sorry I had to tell you that way, Sergeant, but that's the only way I could tell you. He says, I had no idea something like this was going to happen. If to me, he says, personally, he says, but I just feel bad for you. He says, you have my deepest sympathy. So I says, well, where is he now? He says, well, he's in a cemetery up at Signy, where we were. He says, it's one of the first cemeteries in France. So my boys came back and picked me up. I thanked him and gave him a high five and started to tried to dry my eyes and get over the shock, which was hard to do. And they picked me up, and they saw I was all shook up. And my first sergeant says, what's the problem, Sarge? I says, I came to see my kid brother, but I was told he's gone. He's dead. And they both didn't say anything. When I got back to our area, I just jumped out of the Jeep and threw myself on the ground and sat there. And finally, the commanding officer, Major Wolf, came up and sat down beside me. He says, Sarge, I am so, so, so sorry to hear about that. He says, words can't express how I feel, et cetera, et cetera. And then I said, I know where he's buried. Is there any chance of seeing his grave? going to visit his grave, and my major and my commanding officer said, "Yeah, you sure can." And he gave me his driver. After I settled down and got settled a little bit, I got in his Jeep, and we ran over to the cemetery, and I found the guy in charge. He had a big clipboard with onion skin paper all over it, and I told him who I was and why I was there. He says, "Oh, boy, I knew this was going to happen sometime. I just knew it." He said, "Let me see." He said, he started fumbling through the pages. He says, "What was your brother's name?" And I says, "Morris Essick." And he says, "Yeah, here it is. He died July the 8th. He says, "And let me take you to his grave." And he took me to his grave. It was a big cemetery. They had a lot of bodies hadn't even been buried yet. They were all behind a cloth fly around the cemetery. And he walked me up to it, and I started fussing at my brother for not keeping his date and so forth and so on. But anyhow, he assured me that no German had touched that body, that the graves were dug by the Germans, but it was Americans who put those boys in their grave. And he tried to console me in so many ways with his words. And again, he offered his condolences. And I got back in the Jeep and went back to headquarters of my outfit, thanked my commanding officer for letting me go. And before we left that area, he let me go back and see him one more time. And that was about that, but it was shocking. It hurt. It liked to kill me. My commanding officer said, "Now, you cannot write home about casualties, you know. You can write home anything you want, but you can't mention casualties." But he winked at me because he has to censor the mail. Mm-hmm. And he winked at me, which is to tell me, "Go ahead and mention it if you want to." What was so amazing is my mother, I wrote my brother-in-law who was at home, my sister and my brother-in-law, and they broke the news to my mother, but she wouldn't believe it because she hadn't heard from Uncle Sam, gotten that "we regret to inform you" telegram.
Right.
She hadn't received that. As a matter of fact, it was many, many weeks after that she still hadn't received it, so she wouldn't believe it. And I don't know that she thought I was kidding or not, or I was not telling the truth, but what happened was they forgot to enter his name on what they call a disposition report. They left his name out, and consequently it never got to Washington that he was a casualty. And believe it or not, she got a letter of apology and sympathy from President Roosevelt saying how sorry he was that that happened.
Well, and I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and you mentioned that at the time you gave Pip a hard time when you got to his grave. You gave him a hard time about not keeping your date.
Yeah,
but that had to tear you up.
Yeah, it did. Of course, I went into the crying mode again. I says, you promised me we were going to meet, but you didn't say it was going to be this way, Pip. You didn't warn me. And I said, and I just don't know what to say to you, except I just feel bad, and I so many words went through my mind, but I fussed at him and then left him, and I said, "Well, I guess we'll see you sometime back home." And he was one of the first casualties sent back home from Europe to my hometown. He was one of the first war casualties sent back home, and there was a big write-up in the newspaper about it. And he had a full military funeral, which I was able to attend.
And obviously you had no choice but to go on doing what you had to do with the 776th. Was there one thing that kind of helped you stay focused or motivated or more determined to make it home in one piece?
Well, my determination was that if it hadn't been for, these tyrants like Hitler and Mussolini, those guys, he wouldn't have had to be there. So I said, "Well, I've got to do my part to get even with those guys, at least what little bit I can do." I mean, I know my job is small compared to the guys in the infantry and so forth, stuff like that. But I said, "I'm going to do what I have to do to end this thing. Well, do my job the way I was trained to do it, and hopefully we can do them some damage too." And we did.
Obviously, that was one of the toughest experiences you faced. We'll talk about your injuries later. But I imagine there was some excitement the first time, and probably every time, that your guns took out a German plane. Any stories like that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you the story that happened Christmas Eve of 1944. We were guarding an airfield called A-94, A for airfield, 94. And on that airfield, there were P-51 Mustangs and P-38 Lightnings. This was a reconnaissance group. they went around taking pictures of where the enemy might be and so forth and so on.
Right.
They were camera planes, except the Mustangs did carry armament. It was Christmas Eve of 1944, and it was late at night, and we weren't too worried because the Germans hardly ever flew in the black of night. They'd like to fly by the moon. But anyhow, I was on guard that night at A-94 and walking along as best I could in the dark, and we had some Quad 50 machine guns lined up on the runway because the Germans were bound and determined to knock out these airfields, and that was one of our jobs, was to protect these airfields. And along about 10, 11 o'clock at night, I was walking along there and doing just walking as a guard would do, and all of a sudden the sky lit up like crazy. And what happened was a Ju-88, a Junkers 88, which is a medium bomber, came flying down the runway with his bomb bay doors open. And luckily, we had a kid named Hooker sitting in one of those Quad 50 machine guns. And we can't to this day figure out how he saw that thing or anything. But it came in low over the runway, and it was at zero elevation. And Hooker lined his guns up, and he started those Quad 50 machine guns just going like crazy. And he caught that booger. And a plane tried to climb, and all of a sudden, the flames just poured out of that thing, and it crashed behind one of our gun sections. Of course, we couldn't go near it for a while because of the armament in the plane and the flames. But after the all the armament bled itself out and the flames died out, we were able to go to the planes and see what it was and figure out what kind of an aircraft it was. And as I told you before, I think and prior to this, believe it or not, there was a girl flying that plane, a girl. But anyhow...
to the surprise of all of you, I'm sure.
Oh, my gosh. We couldn't believe that either. But anyhow, the next day, the commanding officer of the 10th Photo Reconnaissance Group sent over a case of booze, thanking us very, very much for what we did, and said, get drunk.
That was the Christmas present for the group.
That was our Christmas present. But that was just one instance, but... We've had a lot of those strafing planes come in, and we've managed to, just before, it was near that spot where we found my kid brother. Our first encounter with a Messerschmitt 105, he came in strafing us, and our gun set up, and we caught that guy pretty good, and he crashed behind a farmhouse in France, and an old lady came running up. She was still living in that thing. She said, "Ooh, ooh." And she started talking French. She says, "Ooh, ooh, ooh." She started. We couldn't understand what she was saying, but she was letting us know a plane had crashed behind her house. there was a lot of giggling there, a lot of humor in that stuff too. But you know, as serious as it was, some of it brought on a chuckle or two. You know.
Well, and I've got to imagine that it occurred to you guys at some point that if your job is to shoot down enemy aircraft, that the enemy aircraft might want to drop a few bombs on you, that you guys might make a pretty good target for them.
Well, I'll tell you what. One night, right after we got to France, we had to dig foxholes, too. It was our job to dig foxholes to protect ourselves in case that actually happened. One night, they came in with low-flying bombers and strafing planes. And I, with my buddy, jumped into a foxhole, and we waited out the raid. They came in, and they shot up everything in sight. And fortunately, we didn't get hurt. We were in our foxhole. But we heard something drop right on that. We had that thing covered up with sandbags, you know.
Right.
Had the sandbag, everything. But anyhow, we were down in that thing, and we heard a big thud. And then when it was all over, we found out what that thud was. It was a big chunk of shrapnel, like a part of a satellite, had come down on us, and it fixed itself right into one of those sandbags. As a matter of fact, we found it was still hot, and I got to thinking, what would have happened if that thing would have come right into the foxhole itself? But it landed on one of the sandbags right outside the foxhole. But we had to protect ourselves pretty good because they were after these airfields because they didn't want our planes in the air either chasing them or taking pictures of them.
Makes a lot of sense to me. Well, we're at another point where we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about Eisenhower. We're going to hear about Patton, about your injuries in the spring of 45, and we've got a surprise for you, too. Don't go anywhere. Lou Essick, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I promise I'm going to explain that statement I made at the top of the show, but let's get right back to World War II with Lou Essek, 90 years old. He doesn't sound like it, does he? And he sounds like he's done a little radio before. We'll reveal that for you as well. But let's go back to Europe in World War II, France specifically, as Lou served with the 776th AAA. And Lou, I understand that General Eisenhower actually was in the same vicinity you were, and you have a little story to share about him.
Yeah, you know, one of the first big battles of the war, Paul, was at Saint-Lô, or they call it in France, Saint-Lô.
Right.
But that was a big, big battle, and that went on for a long time. And so finally there was a breakthrough, and we were able to move after the Battle of Saint-Lô, and we were moving down the highway in a convoy, and I was on a 2.5-ton truck with no tarp over the top. It was wide open. And as we were moving down the road, there was this staff car that pulled off the road and just sat on the side of the road as we went by. And we were traveling very, very slow, as convoys do. As we passed this staff car, I looked inside. I was leaning over the railing of the truck, looking right down into that thing, and lo and behold, sitting in the staff car in the back seat with his lady driver up front was General Eisenhower. I don't know what came over me, but I grabbed my rifle and I came to a formal gun salute, which, of course, is taboo. You never do that, and you never do it in a truck. But anyhow, I came to this formal gun salute, and I saluted him, and he looked at me, and he sort of gave me this halfway grin. He nodded his head and looked at me and then shook his head as if to say, how in the world are we going to win this war with something like that? But anyhow, he did grin, and he nodded his head, and we went on the way. And all the guys poked me and said, what did you do that for, Sarge? You're not supposed to do that. You should know better. But anyhow, that was quite funny, and I'll never forget it, that especially the look on his face.
Well, and it makes you wonder how often things like that happened for him. I'm sure everyone, you know, was struck by his presence and wanted to make an impression, but few probably had the cojones that you displayed in that situation.
Anyhow, you know, the first time I'd heard his voice ever was the night before the invasion when he was talking to the troops. It was a big loudspeaker. So we were down in Falmouth in Wales, and in the harbor on the channel were all of these invasion ships and all kinds of ships getting ready to go. I happened to be down there checking on some of my guns. I knew the invasion was coming because he was making that speech about we're about to embark on, you know what, so forth and so on. So it sort of thrilled me to be able to look him in the eye.
Well, speaking of voices you'll never forget, a voice a little more gruff. We talk about the Third Army. Everyone knows it as Patton's Third Army because of old blood and guts himself, General George S. Patton.
Yeah, he was our boss.
And you witnessed him in rare form.
Yeah, we were in a beautiful little city called Chalon-sur-Marne. That's Chalon on the Marne River. The Germans had bombed out the main bridge in that town as they retreated. They just bombed out the whole main bridge, which was a big bridge. And, of course, General Patton's tanks needed that bridge to cross as they were chasing the enemy because the war was fast coming to a halt, and the enemy was on the run, and that bridge was needed by Patton's tanks to keep their in pursuit of the enemy. They had German prisoners building that bridge, I mean 24/7.
Right.
It had to be built in a hurry because, as I say, Patton's tanks were on the way. Well, General Patton and his entourage, his staff, came over that bridge, and they were at the other end of the bridge watching as the tanks were coming across, and I happened to be sitting on one of the guns when they were coming across, one of our anti-aircraft guns. I was on one of the platforms.
Right.
And here come the tanks, and this one tank had a tank commander. They're the ones who stand up in the turret with
exactly.
Their arms folded, you know, like generals.
Right.
There was this one sergeant, he was a tech sergeant. He was standing up in the turret as the tanks were coming across, and General Patton was standing there so proudly watching his tanks as they came across, and this one tank with this guy had a cigarette dangling from his mouth. Oh, my gosh, that's taboo. You just got to be West Point with General Patton, 100% West Point. As he was coming across the bridge with that cigarette dangling from his mouth, I saw Patton point to him, point to one of his staff members, And he was mad as a hornet. He had both hands on his pearl-handled pistol. You could tell he was cussing up a storm. And this guy was a tech sergeant coming across the bridge, but when he reached the other side near Patton, he was a private. He was literally demoted on the spot, but Patton got so mad because, as I said, we had a lot of Patton's commanding officers come into our area to check us out. And I tell you what, he wanted your shoes polished even if you were standing in mud. He was 100% West Point. He was a booger. But this is the way he was, and he got the job done.
Well, and at least you weren't the object of his ire in that situation. You talked about shooting down enemy airplanes. But as many people know, late in the war, the caliber of aircraft that you were up against changed considerably. Had it changed earlier, things might have been a little different. But once the Germans employed the Messerschmitt 262, the first jet plane to ever be deployed, you guys had a little harder time keeping track of planes like that.
Yeah, well, it was because of that that I wound up injured the way I was. What happened was these forward area sights, the things you aim through. You've seen sights on guns and stuff.
Right.
Well, we had two sights on each gun, each of our 40-millimeter guns and our quad 50 machine guns that you had to aim through. But they have these speed rings. These are circular sights. And they have speed rings in them. Well, the point is, on the propeller-driven craft, we could keep those planes in our sights in order to be able to get a bead on them and get a shot at them. Well, you couldn't do that with a jet. They just couldn't keep them in their sights long enough to get a bead on a jet. So they modified those sights, and I was told I had to go to a certain place marked on a map to pick up some new sights for our 40-millimeter guns and our machine guns. All of our transportation was out that day. Our trucks were out. Our reconnaissance cars were out. So our chaplain was nice enough to let me use his Jeep and his driver, a young fellow by the name of Joe Razanowskis from Massachusetts. And he said, you can use my Jeep if you like, and can you get all those sights in the Jeep? I said, we can try. So Joe and I took off, and we found the spot on the map that they told us to go. It was an ordnance company. We loaded all the new sights on our Jeep, and we were on our way back. And on our way back is the last I can remember, except I woke up 3 days later in one of those MASH-type hospitals, the 40th Field and Evacuation Hospital. At the time I woke up, I didn't know who I was or where I was. And a nurse was standing over me, and she said, just take your time. It'll all come back to you. It's all foggy right now, but the fog will lift. And then finally, I did remember who I was. And finally, I remembered I was in a Jeep. And finally, I remembered I was with Joe. And I finally yelled out, well, where's Joe? Is he here? And they told me that Joe was killed in that crash. And that was the long and short of that. But I spent 6 months in the hospital. My left knee was crushed. I had a bad slice on my ear. My left eye was in bad shape, but they fixed that. And I went from hospital to hospital and finally wound up back in the States at the hospital in Indiana.
Well, it sounds like you must have felt pretty fortunate just to be alive.
Oh, gracious goodness me. After they told me, well, what happened was somebody found us wherever we were. It just came to light today, thanks to you, that what really happened there. And I, to this day, I didn't even know what had happened until you searched it out and brought it to light. I could never find out exactly what happened. It seems that we were passing a convoy, and the Jeep went out of control, and we hit a tree, and that was about it. And I was glad to find that out. But I was lucky when they told me Joe was dead. It was just like finding out about my kid brother almost. He was a fine young man. He was the chaplain's altar boy. He set up mass, you know, when they had services and stuff like that. But it was something, though. It really was. My poor mother, you know, back home, she became a gold star mother with three stars in the window and one gold star for my brother Pip. So she went through it, too.
And you came close to giving her another gold star. I'm sure she was very thankful that you didn't. And what about you coming home? How exciting was that to get through what you got through and know that you were coming back in a free world to a free country?
Oh, it was really, really thrilling. I mean, what happened was we left. After all these hospitals I was in France, we finally left from Bristol, England. We left from there for the United States. We were coming back by way of the North Atlantic, but there was bad weather in the North Atlantic. We were supposed to go to a Halloran General Hospital in New York. That's where we were bound. They had to change course, and we wound up going to a hospital in Charleston, South Carolina. It was called Stark General Hospital. It was just a wartime hospital that they had set up for us. I'll tell you what, there were some of the greatest heroes I've ever... This was a big, big English ship called the Atlantis. It was a luxury ship that was made into a hospital ship. I thought I was in bad shape till I got on that ship. I was aboard that ship with some real, real heroes. I mean, we had two fighter pilots on that ship. And believe it or not, both of them crashed. And both of them wound up with bad injuries, but mainly their faces were burned so badly.
Mm.
And these two pilots met on that ship, and they got to be real good friends. They started a contest with each other. One said to the other, I said, I'll make you a bet. I'll bet I'm uglier than you are. And the other one says, no, you can't be uglier than me. He said, yeah, I think I am. So they went up to that, and they looked in the mirror and says, no, you win. You're uglier. They were funny, but they were so brave. And, I mean, they were badly burned. But we had so many. To me, they were all heroes. But I was so proud when we pulled into Charleston Harbor. It was like a big celebration. They had these ships with those big hoses going over the water, you know?
Right.
We had a band meet us. And I think that was the proudest moment of my life when they carried me off that ship on a litter. A lot of the citizens were there to greet that boat, the Atlantis, and they just applauded and cheered. And that was a proud moment for me.
Makes you feel like you were doing something worthwhile, huh?
Well, like you said at the beginning of our little talk, after I found Pip Dead, you wanted to do something for your country. You know what I mean? You had to do something. And I felt like, you know, I did my little bit of a part as I could.
Well, speaking of things that I said at the top of the show, it's probably about time for me to explain something. You know, I talk each week with these veterans, and many of them were not married, had no children when they went to war. All of that happened after they came home. In your case, there are four children, four grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren who would never have been born. And I made the statement that this show probably wouldn't be on the air without you. So I'm going to explain that now, because when you got home, you eventually embarked on a 40-year career in radio. And it's
right.
My understanding that your career in radio inspired your nephew Skip Essick, is our program director here at KMJ. And you know full well, Lou, that in radio and broadcasting, if you don't have people in management supporting you, there's not a whole lot you can do. And when I came to Skip with the idea years ago of doing this show, he embraced it wholeheartedly. He's given me the opportunity to do it, and it's really been a neat thing for everybody. And Skip is here right now, and I want him to explain why you were his inspiration in getting into radio. Can you do that for me, Skip?
I will. Hey, Uncle Lou, how are you?
Hey, Skip. Good to talk to you, buddy.
Surprise.
Yeah,
I've been sitting here listening to all this. It's terrific. Good to hear you again. I saw you back in June down on Jekyll Island, down in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And how's the knee?
The knee, believe it or not, I'm walking again. I'm not on a walker anymore.
Good.
I'm not on a cane anymore, and I'm still going to physical therapy. My last session is tomorrow. My doctor has given me a clean bill of health and said, I don't want to see you for 3 months, and I'm walking real good now.
That's really good news. That's good news. I think that this is the first time that you and I have ever been on the radio together.
Isn't this something? This is a landmark, isn't it?
It is. It's family history. Uncle Lou inspired me to be in radio when I was a child. He and the family would come up from North Carolina to visit us. We all lived in Toledo, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had a neat car, and he was on the radio, and I just thought that would be the greatest thing in the world, you know, to be on the radio. And so that's how I was inspired. And I stuck with it. And Uncle Lou was always my inspiration.
And you never tried to talk him out of it, Lou?
Huh?
You never tried to talk him out of it?
I'll tell you what, I'm so proud of what he's accomplished in radio. It would just be like as if I was his daddy. My chest is, every time I think about it, my chest just comes out further and further. I'm just so proud of Skip of what he's accomplished. He's done a great job for radio.
Well, I appreciate that. Of course, I couldn't have, you know, seriously, you were the inspiration, so...
I'm glad. I was happy to do that, Chip.
Well, so our little impromptu family reunion here, but I really mean it. I mean, it sounds like I'm saying that lightly, but I truly believe that this show might not be on the air if you hadn't done what you did, Lou, because Skip wouldn't have had that example, that reason to get into radio, and I wouldn't have had a guy here who believed in the idea and gave it a chance to flourish. So it's amazing how things work out.
How serendipitous.
Exactly.
All right.
And Lou, in closing, anything else about your time in the service that you want to share or any thoughts about, you know, you had two brothers who were in the war as well, your entire generation of friends who did what they
did. One thing I want to remember, I was at the Wakeman Convalescent Hospital in Indiana, near Indianapolis. That was the last hospital I was in before I was discharged. I hadn't seen my brother Dave, the one that went to the Pacific, in years. And it was so great because when I got my convalescent furlough to go home and visit, someone had to come and get me. And when my brother Dave walked into that ward, and he was always kidding me, I tell you, I got the biggest lump in my throat because just to see my brother Dave after his stint in the Pacific, and he got out alive, and he looked down at the bed at me. I was still sitting on the bed, and he said, "Hello, Crip." He called me Crip, Cripple. "You know, Crip, you ready to go home?" And I tell you what, that was the thrill of one of the big thrills, just having him come in and see me home. That was great.
No doubt about it. Well, from one family reunion to another one in years past that certainly had some great meaning. We're running out of time, Lou, but I just want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for setting the example for Skip and putting the ball in motion. And thanks for sharing just a few of your stories with us today.
Paul, I thank you for thinking of us World War II veterans. I think it's great.
Well, it's my privilege to hang out with guys like Lou every week, and we'll do it again next week. That's our edition of Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.